My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big MQL man. Then he just kept saying things like, the more MQLs, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means marketing qualified lead. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the MQL man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/customer to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/customer. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than their worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. Ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What if we took away the biggest hurdle, which is people not being able to, you know, number one, execute? They don't have a successful trading plan and strategy that's actually back tested on data. What if we built that into a software that then allowed them to be able to execute and not have to be staring at a screen all day?
Imagine turning your life around, going from a broke drug addict to becoming a challenger to Wall Street, running funds worth tens of millions of dollars and jet setting around the world. Well, it's not only been done many times, it's been done by my next guest. I'm talking about Jeff Seckinger. His story is amazing. He went from college grad straight to Wall Street to burned out drug addict, found out that he hated his life, and decided to change his life through a couple strategic moves. Next thing you know, he's in Miami, he's running a fund, rivaling some of the Wall Street funds in New York, making tens of millions of dollars, and he is going to break down this step-by-step process for us so we can do the same thing. No matter where you're at in life, if you're a broke drug addict like he was or somewhere in the middle, we can all learn from this. Jeff, thanks so much for joining me today.
Absolutely.
Man, the good conversation is always before we start recording, but let's just go ahead and just jump right in. You know, we were deep into disrupting Wall Street. We were deep into trading, investing, and we were just about to talk about the banks and how safe the banks are. And we're going to do that. But let's just start back at the beginning now that we're recording. So, you know, the big thing I like to talk about is disrupting markets. And as I was kind of explaining to you, you know, I think there's the five big legacy institutions in the world today need to be disrupted. And that's media, that's health, that's education, certainly finance. And sort of that's kind of where you're at. So let's just start kind of at the beginning. I mean, you're young, you're pretty dang successful, you're making a lot of money. And you're not doing it the traditional way. So you're definitely disrupting markets.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that. You have a hedge fund or some sort of a fund, right?
Yeah.
And then you have another business that helps people trade and invest.
Mm-hmm.
And you're in Miami. So you're not in Wall Street and you're doing this. Like, give us your background. How'd you get here?
Yeah, so I mean, my parents growing up, they worked traditional jobs. Then my dad became an entrepreneur probably when I was like 5 years old. So we moved. I was born in Pittsburgh, moved to Louisville, Kentucky, and then probably around the age of five, we moved to Columbus, Ohio. He started an energy business, so I got to see what, you know, an entrepreneur kind of goes through it, right? They spend a lot of time at work building this thing for many, many years. And my parents ended up getting divorced, so we moved out. Like, he did pretty well in his previous job, so they built a house in Columbus in a pretty nice neighborhood. We lived in a big house. Then we moved when they split. It was right before like 2008. We then moved out of that big house into a much smaller apartment and a smaller house, and I got to see what stress brought from, you know, not having financial security.
Yeah.
And I think at an early age I related more stress to, you know, not doing well financially, and then like a lack of security to not doing well financially. But I also saw the other side. So I think from a young age, you know,
the other side of what?
The other side of also doing well financially. Oh, yeah. And the security and the less stress that that brings.
Got it.
So from an early age, I don't know why. I didn't know why. I think I know why now. But I was like cleaning my parents' baseboards for 25 cents a room. I was doing the lemonade stands. I sold baseball cards. I did, ran a little landscaping company, you know, just laying mulch for people in my neighborhood. I was always doing all these things to make money.
Yeah.
And I was a little bit of felt like an outcast because not many people were doing that. So anyways, I went through, you know, traditional public school in Columbus. Then I went to University of Kentucky for my finance degree. You know, I was in did apprenticeship roles. I did a bunch of internships. What I learned from an early age was this. There was a financial advisor in Columbus that I kind of did an apprenticeship with. And he was like, you know, the closer you can get to the money, the better.
Mm.
So I'm like, let me get closer to the money. Let me be around, you know, wealthier people. Yeah. So I wanted to be a financial advisor. So I got out of college, got my degree in 2016. The next month I'm working for JP Morgan in Columbus, Ohio, and their biggest office is like 12,000 employees, 2 million square feet. It's massive. It's the second biggest corporate office behind the Pentagon. So I was there for about 18 months. I got, you know, different licenses and things. And then I realized that that wasn't what I wanted to do. Also an even bigger part of my story, which we can, I'll go surface level. If you want to go deeper, we can, but I got injured in football. And I was also just hanging around the wrong people in high school, but I got addicted to opiates. And, you know, for the first 2 years, it was like somewhat, you know, fun, right? This is just, you know, a thing that it gave me a different type of a mindset. It took away the pain from the injury that I had. I tore all the ribs, the muscles in my ribs playing football. So anytime I breathed or moved, it hurt pretty bad. So they prescribed me Percocet. That rolled in. Once those ran out, I started to do worse things. Next thing you know, I'm, you know, two years go by and I'm still, you know, somewhat having fun with it. Then the next 4 years, I'm trying to quit. So this is all through college, pretty much. I'm trying to quit using, and then into JP Morgan, I'm trying to quit using. I'm finally seeing doctors. They're prescribing me all these other things, try to get off of the, you know, the other opiates, but in reality, they're just prescribing me other opiates. Yeah. It has a longer half-life that's harder to even get off. So I mean, I went through a struggle for 4 years, and it was going through college, you know, still getting, you know, a 3.0, 3.2. Everything looks good on the outside.
Yeah.
I'm selling, you know, I'm driving to, instead of partying all the time, I'm driving to outlet malls, buying a bunch of shoes out of these outlet malls, in my Nissan Altima. Fill my Nissan Altima with shoes. I'm coming home. People are partying in the house because I live with other people, and I'm like carrying like hundreds of shoes up the stairs, trying to make that, you know, just, I still had that entrepreneurial, you know, need in my life. And then, you know, I went into JP Morgan, and I finally felt like I was on track. I'm like, this is what I'm meant to do. This is what I wanted to do my whole life. And then I realized that it wasn't what I actually wanted to do. I was actually living for other people's values. Because I took this course from John DeMartini called the Values Determination course, and I realized what my highest values were, and they were, you know, having uncapped earning potential, seeing impact on other people, and having freedom, options, and choices to do what I, you know, I can with my time, energy, and resources on Earth. And I didn't have those things. I wasn't seeing impact. I didn't have the freedom, and I definitely didn't have uncapped earning potential. So I realized this all kind of came together. This was in like 2017. I'm taking out loans to try to take care of my habit, which got really bad. It spiraled about as bad as it gets. Crashed my car a few times because I fell asleep, and then I ended up finally I got to a place where I had to fix something because I had no more sick days at work. I'm over 60 grand in debt at this point. I'm living in my dad's basement. I have a just beat up Honda Civic that I was leasing.
Yeah.
And I was like, I still loved, I was always, you know, trading and investing. But at that point in time, I'm like, I just dug myself into a hole. So I had to go to my mom found an inpatient place. I always like push that stuff away. I think it's because of my ego a little bit. I'm like, and also I'm like, that's not who I am.
Right.
I don't belong in a rehabilitation center. So I'm finally like, I don't have any other choice. So I go in to try to get an assessment done to go to outpatient. And they're like, you are way too bad. You have to go to inpatient.
Really?
They wouldn't accept me. So right after that, my dad called. I'm supposed to go into work because I got no more sick days. And he's like, Jeff, what'd they say? And they're like, I'm like, they won't accept me. I have to go to inpatient. So I the next morning I was on a flight to Knoxville, Tennessee, to a place called Cornerstone of Recovery. Went into there, realized that, you know, I was having chills, not just because I was sick, but because I had all these visions for what I want to do with my life. And it was 4 years of just pent up, you know, trying to get out of that situation and trying to get my life back on track. And I was doing all these things, but I didn't have the foundation built because I had shitty habits and I was, you know, addicted.
Yeah.
And then I used that place as a place to reset. I had a counselor named Christopher that made me write a hero story. So the hero story is like me stepping outside of who I was and into my own hero. And I wrote a story, and I still have the paper of you know, what my life was leading up into this point. And then you, from this point forward, you then project what you're going to do. So I wrote that story, and then I also built a vision board in rehab after I got out of the detox facility. And then a lot of those things that I put on my vision board are now happening. And, you know, my hero story is honestly playing out as well. It's projected further into the future, so we'll see if it does. But you know, that point in time, I'm like, I just use it as a place to kind of reset, build a foundation that I could actually have a really big quantum leap from. And I was already working on personal development stuff. So when I got out, I just had my mom with all my employees in Miami, and we were talking about some of my story in front of all my employees. And she's like, yeah, like when Jeff got out, he was not like, that was the one chance I needed. That's all I needed was to get off of that stuff for a little bit, get my head back on track. When I got out, I didn't do anything except for focus on working out and focus on entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
So I actually went back into corporate though, right when I got out. And then I realized that's why I was continuing the problem. I was just escaping my life. I had a life that I was living for other people, for my, you know, family, friends, peers, what I thought they thought was successful. And I said, screw what everyone else thinks. Let me figure out what I value in life and start living my own life.
Yeah.
And I realized, you know, again, those highest values that I had. And I'm like, I just got to build a life around what I value. But I, you know, when I got out, I was 60 grand in debt. Then I had, you know, I wasn't paying my bills. So I had a 524 credit score as well. I had late payments. I had a collection as well. So I realized if I'm trying to get out of my dad's basement and go do something great with my life, I got to fix my credit. So I fixed my credit and I just started to build a brand because I read Crush It by Gary Vee. And I'm like, this is the truth.
Yep.
This is 100% the truth. This is where the future is going. I used to hate social media. I thought it was just so superficial.
Yeah.
But I'm like, there's people doing big business from this. So I read that book. I'm like, I'm going all in on brand. I was posting 3 to 4 times a day on Instagram, still in corporate. And then I once again, you know, I realized the corporate, it's not bad. I love JP Morgan and Chase. They're a great company. But the thing is, it just didn't make sense for what I wanted to get out of life. So I declared an outside business to them, which was like I was, you know, writing business plans, something I learned from a company that I interned with in Australia, actually, in like 2015. And then I coupled in some of the things that I was learning about my own credit, like funding, to help startups get funding without, you know, giving up equity and paying a bunch of interest and all this stuff. So I declared that outside business to them. They're like, hey, that's going to be a competition to some of our partners. And I'm like, all right, well, I got to do this. So I literally, that was on Friday. They said, like, you can't run it pretty much. the next Monday, I just turned in my badge at 8 a.m. and said, I gotta pursue this. Because if I don't, I'm going to slip back to my problem, because once again, I'm living a reality that I don't want to live. So anyways, I did that. That company didn't do super well to start because I didn't understand client acquisition and marketing. So I actually, to bridge the gap, I started a marketing company where we mainly focused on doctors and chiropractors with one other entrepreneur in Columbus. We did pretty well there, and I kept building my brand. And then for a couple months, we were making enough money where I got to move out of my dad's basement. I lived in an apartment. I was paying down my debt. I learned to move all my personal debt over to business debt so that I could have a little bit of room, bring my credit score up. And then everything just started to click. Took probably 6 months, and I started to launch my own brand and actually build a digital product. First month I did $5,000, then it was like 12, 25, and it just kept growing and went faster than I ever would have believed that I could do that. And next thing you know, I'm completely out of debt. I got a really great life. I'm living in San Diego. I launched a hedge fund. And then, about a year and a half go by in San Diego, pandemic happens. I moved to Miami. So now I've been in Miami 3 years now. So now I've got three different brands. I still have that credit-based funding brand. I've got that algorithmic trading brand that's called NERP. And then I've got my hedge fund that I've had for, in April of this year will be 5 years.
All right, I want to take a break real quick just to let you know that if you're sick of the global elites robbing you blind through frivolous money printing like I am, then you should be at the Bitcoin 2024 conference in Nashville, Tennessee, July 25th through 27th. It's the largest Bitcoin gathering fintech conference in the world. In 2024, Bitcoin stands as a beacon of monetary freedom, a glimmer of hope amongst a darkening macroeconomic backdrop. Come hang out with me and other top speakers, companies, thought leaders from across the industry. We'll all be in Nashville looking ahead to the next year and beyond. Now, ticket prices are on sale right now, and you can get an extra 10% off if you use my code MARKMOSS. But make sure you secure your spot right now. It's going to sell out, and ticket prices go up over time. Use Mark Moss for a 10% off discount. And if you do, send me your code that you used my code to buy your ticket, and I'm going to invite you to a special event that I'm having. So make sure you get your ticket, Bitcoin 2024. Use Mark Moss for 10% off, and I hope to see you there.
My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big MQL man. Then he just kept saying things like, the more MQLs, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means marketing qualified lead. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the MQL man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/customer to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/customer. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than their worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members of FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Man, what a story.
Yeah.
There's a lot to dig into on that. You know, I want to talk about the disrupting markets. I want to talk about the finance space. That's my main domain of expertise. But there's a lot to unpack here that I want to get into. A couple of things that that hit me. One of them sounds like you've done sort of quite a bit of based off of what you told me. You spent quite a bit of time kind of thinking about your past and sort of reverse engineering how did I get here and what were these levers. You talked about your dad being the entrepreneur. And how you're able to see sort of both sides of like, hey, doing better and doing worse kind of a thing. I've often thought about my own past experience as well. Like my dad was a contractor. He's an entrepreneur, mm-hmm. right? He went and bid jobs, closed jobs, completed jobs. He made me go to work with him all the time. And like, I feel like that, like we're learning through just modeling, right? And so like my dad just made money. He didn't really have a job.
Yeah.
He just made money, right? And like he would take me with him as a young kid, and I saw that, and I feel like that was like a big piece that like led me to where I'm at. I guess, would you feel the same way? You think it was like sort of like that modeling? They say kids learn through like hypnosis, meaning they're not, it's kind of going past their conscious, like directly to the subconscious like that.
Yeah, I think that piece 100% true, but I also think what you're missing early in life, when I say early, I'm talking about really below the age of 10, becomes what you value later in life. So if you've got a big void early on, like maybe your parents don't, you know, show you enough love, or they didn't have money, or you had some type of thing that you felt was missing, which you wouldn't consciously know at the time, mm-hmm. that becomes something that you a lot of the times value a lot in the future. Yeah. But yeah, I
you know, we grew up and as a contractor, there was good times and bad times. So we had the good and we had the bad.
Yes.
And my dad worked really hard to make sure we went to private school. Mm. And like, so we were around more well-off, you know, rich kids.
Yeah.
And I could see it, but we didn't have it. Mm. And they say a lot of times, like the middle-class kids, maybe they can do better because it's that gap. Like you're saying, like the poor people, the poor kids never saw it. Mm-hmm. They don't even know. The rich kids had it too easy. But like I saw it, but I didn't have it. And then it created that gap. Like I wanted it. Right.
Yep.
And so I didn't have the brand new bike or the cool clothes or whatever it was that everyone else did. So then I, like you, had to take my skill set to my market. So at, you know, 8, 9 years old, I knew how to mow lawns, and my market was my neighborhood.
Yep.
And let me take my skill set to my market and let's see what can happen, right? And you know, my whole life has always been, I've never had a job. You know, you went down, you tried that career path a little bit. I had one job, but it's always just been like, how do I make money?
Mm-hmm.
Just how does money get made? How do I make it? And I think, again, like back to my dad.
I think that's super important. When I have kids in the future, I hope that they see both sides.
Yeah.
Because you have to, if you're too comfortable and you've got the golden handcuffs, it's probably going to ruin the rest of your life.
Yeah.
But if you see both sides, you can say, okay, well, hard work gets me here. Being lazy gets me here. What do I want out of my life? And then, you know, for me and you, obviously it's been working a bit harder to get after the money and create a, you know, a life of freedom, options and choices. So
yeah, on the working harder part, this is a little sidetrack, but last night, yesterday, for everybody listening, yesterday we were at an event, Carlton's Tax Alchemy event. We went to dinner last night. Thanks for inviting me, by the way.
Yeah.
It's been raining here in California. When the rain happens, the dirt's really good. I like to ride dirt bikes, and all my buddies were going to go ride dirt bikes yesterday, and it's going to be so good. And I really wanted to go, but I was like, I kind of want to go to this event. It's a work event, right? It's like work. But the point is, I was thinking this morning, I'm a little bit of a high from yesterday and last night, because the amount of masterminding and conversations we had, just like, I'm ready to go work even harder. But I was thinking about it, and it's like, if you hate to work, then that sounds miserable.
No, yeah.
I opted to go work over going and riding dirt bikes.
Yep.
And so like when you said working harder, it's like, yeah, like trying to play tennis better, trying to surf better, trying to ride motocross better. I want to work better too. So it's like, anyway, that was something that I've been thinking about this morning. And you had talked about you were hanging around the wrong people. Mm-hmm. But then think about, you know, last night hanging around the right people, how powerful it was. But I want to go back to one other thing you said. You talked about that you had taken a values determination course.
Yeah.
Sounds pretty cool. Mm-hmm. That's something I talk about quite a bit. A lot of people ask me, like, I get stuck with analysis paralysis or I don't know what to do. And for me, I feel that going back, I spent a lot of time in personal development as well, learning what my core values were gave me this filter all of a sudden to like filter everything against and very quickly make decisions.
Yeah.
And it sounds like that's kind of what it was for you.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, if you don't know what you value, you have no clear path and vision. You can't create a vision that it makes sense to what you truly want out of life. So then, and if you don't know what you want, you're going to be living someone else's dream.
Yep.
And then you're going to have all these problems, maybe obesity. You don't have to escape your life with drugs. You can escape it with Netflix.
Yeah.
Or gambling or all these other things, right? So you're going to be on a really low vibrational frequency if you're always living for other people's, you know, wants, needs, desires.
Yeah.
But once you start to realize what you value, you can create your life around that. And like you said, it's a filter. So every decision that you make, it's like, hey, does this align with one of my three values or not? If it doesn't, let's not spend time on it. Let's focus on the things that do.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it's crazy they don't teach things like that and credit and taxes in school, because that is like, you know, some of the most important stuff in your life. So yeah, anyone watching this, I don't know if you know who John DeMartini is, but I think he's one of the better teachers about that stuff. And that really gave me a clear direction of what I wanted to do. I mean, without that, I don't know what I would be doing.
Right? Yeah.
I don't know if I'd be alive.
I probably spent 10 years reading, and I still do. I'm still a junkie. But 10 years in like personal development, like reading all those guys, you know, from Napoleon Hill to Brian Tracy to you name it, right? And I used to read a bunch of books on goal setting because I'm like, I need to set goals. I need to achieve goals. That's what I have to do. But almost the good books anyway, almost all the good books, they start with what are your core values? And I was like, skip past that. Let me just get to the goal setting. But it wasn't until years later that I was like, well, the reason why I'm not setting good goals is because I haven't taken the time to establish my values.
Yeah.
And so I had to go back and do that. And ever since I did that, my life has just taken off that way.
Yeah.
You also talked about having a vision board. And so it goes back to what you're kind of saying. A quote I tell my daughter, she just graduated high school. I say, you know, you're either going to build the life that you want, or someone else will hire you to build the life they want, right?
Yeah.
Their dream. And so you did the values, you did your vision board, and you clearly identified what you wanted. And now you're living it out. I love that part. So I just kind of want to hit on that. All right. Now you started the business and it's been growing ever since. Let's talk about that. So you just said that school doesn't teach us what we need. So again, we're trying to disrupt markets, education being one of them.
Yeah.
So the school doesn't teach you anything about anything, right? They have a personal finance course, some schools do, which is like teaches you to be a really good consumer.
Yeah. Maybe some accounting.
Maybe you can balance your budget, your checkbook, but most people probably don't even learn that. But you really don't understand much about how the world works, specifically around money. So I put up a story yesterday. I said, so a lot of people, unsuccessful people think the world is rigged against them. Successful people realize the world is rigged and they learn how to play that game. So we think about money. Let's talk about that. So you help people get, your first business was, and you still have, helping people establish credit and get credit.
Yeah.
And so most people don't really realize that we're in a debt-based monetary system. Money is actually created through debt issuance.
Yep.
And so like people would say like, oh, I wish I had a money tree in my backyard. I remember hearing that as a kid growing up all the time. I wish I had a money tree. But we do. Like the money tree, like I can go get $1 million right now to go buy a business or a building if I want.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you kind of think about the debt creation or the access to capital and credit like that?
Yeah, I mean, that is literally, I mean, if you look at the charts that I talked about yesterday, everything's going parabolic as far as M2 and the issues of new debt, and the interest that we're paying on the debt is now exceeding what we're spending on our military a year.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that's, I think, the most difficult part is to kind of realize how money is created, what money truly is, and then how to actually leverage it. So, like you said, you know, the basic consumer, they'll say that, oh, the whole system's set up against me. What the successful person says is, okay, these are the rules, and now let me find out how to use the rules to benefit me. So yeah, the most successful will understand debt. They'll start to use debt in a proper manner. But a lot of the consumers base, like they're not, you know, producing any type of value. They just start to consume. So I always talk about, hey, are you a consumer or are you a producer? So when I, you know, had 60 grand in debt that then went to 80 grand in debt, because I was investing back in myself and all that interest, I was a consumer. I was consuming over and over again. I was consuming crappy food, crappy knowledge, watching the news, obviously drugs, doing a lot of, you know, just consumer-based stuff. Then I, when I transitioned, I'm like, hey, how can I become a producer? So I flipped all the debt that I had from consumer debt into then business debt that's producing for me. So yeah, if you're in the consumer mindset still, debt is a terrible thing for you to get into.
Yeah.
But if you step into a role where you're like, hey, I'm going to produce, then debt can be a huge catalyst to you, you know, getting to the next level.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than their worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members of FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rocked the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! LeBron!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storr on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Unsuccessful people think that the game is rigged, kind of going off of what I said. But successful people realize that there's just a set of rules. And so I talk about this all the time. So there's like a game of money, and you just have to understand the game. And so what are the rules, the parameters that successful people use?
Well, they learn how debt works and how money works.
Yep.
They realize that they can't be a consumer. They got to step into that producer role.
Yep.
And then, you know, on a higher level, like, you know, if you really start to, how I thought about wealth building, because I wanted to, I'm going to build a lot of wealth in my life. So I said, what vehicle do I need to be in? A lot of people, they have these really big aspirational goals, but they're in the wrong vehicle. They don't deserve what they want. So if you want something, you got to deserve it. But in order to deserve it, you got to get in the right vehicle. So if I'm trying to go to China, am I going to hop in a Tesla and drive to China? No, that's impossible.
Right.
So if you've got a vision to be worth $100 million, you working at the Burger King drive through is not going to get you there. But if you step out and say, hey, I'm going to, you know, own 100 Burger Kings and scale this, right, and actually become step into the right vehicle, then you can actually hit those types of goals. So there's a big disconnect. You could call it a little bit of cognitive dissonance, where you've got this vision for you, but you're not taking the actions that lead up to that. So yeah, I mean, the big thing with goal setting is figuring out a target that you actually want. You got to identify what you want, which I think comes from the foundation of the values that you figure out in your life.
Yep.
Then you actually set a plan to execute on that. You set a deadline, and then you take consistent action. I always talk about those are the four things that you need to achieve any goal in life. So I think a lot of, you know, consumers and people that are new, they don't understand that piece, and they don't get in the right vehicle. So, you know, if I'm looking at how do I build as much wealth as possible, that's why I'm in the hedge fund space. That's why I'm building a SaaS company, because I understand that that's how I can accrue the most amount of value, not just to, you know, the clients that we have, but also to help hit my goals in the future.
Yeah. I love when you talked about your path, like your first business you launched was a service-based business.
Yeah.
And so like when you think about like a lot of people, they think about like they have to have a bunch of money to make money, but like it's not true.
No.
And most people can just start a high leverage service-based business right away. We all have skills. I talked about, I had a skill of mowing lawns and I could just take that to my market.
Yeah.
Anyone can pressure wash driveways or paint houses, right? The other thing that you said was you wanted to be close to the money. So even like service-based businesses, like I say, you should learn skills that are close to the money, sales and marketing.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Jeff, if I brought you $1 million this year, would you give me $100,000?
Yeah,
of course you
most
would.
Likely.
Right. And if I know sales and marketing, like then I could do that. Right. So I kind of think about it like that.
Yeah.
All right. So now you started a service-based business that sort of helped people realize the first part, which is we're in a debt-based monetary system and you can get access to capital. So that's kind of helping people start generating wealth through capital. And now you have the an algorithmic trading system, mm-hmm. service, whatever you call that.
Yeah,
let's talk about a SaaS, a software. Yeah. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah. So we build successful trading strategies into softwares so that a user, we mainly work with higher net worth retail traders. So a user can come in.
What's that?
What do you mean?
What's a higher level retail trader?
Higher net worth.
Right.
So yeah, I mean like their account size are typically just bumping up into the six-figure mark.
Six figures.
So they're typically, yeah, they're maybe average, maybe they're worth around 500 to, you know, $1 million.
Okay. So they have about $100,000 in their that they're investing with or trading with.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, so what I realized, I launched a product in 2021. This is the first trading product that I ever launched. Okay, so I'm running my hedge fund for multiple years. People are seeing the whole market blow up because I'm in the crypto, you know, industry.
Yep.
And I'm starting to share some of the things that I'm doing online. I'm like, and people just keep messaging, asking. That's how you know when consumers ask for something.
Yep.
And you're like, and they keep asking over and over again. That's a sign that you should deliver some type of product to them, because they're looking for value, but you haven't given the value that they're looking for.
Yep.
So I just was like, one night I'm like, you know what? Screw it. I'm just going to get a payment link for $197 a month. And I'm just going to say, hey, I'm just going to start sharing what I know and what I'm doing. If you want to join, join here. Launch it. And I don't even know how much we did, but it was a lot of sales at once. I mean, definitely tens of thousands right away.
Yeah.
It bumped up over 100,000. And at the peak, it was like 350 a month recurring. So I'm like, wow, there's something major here. But the problem is when I'm, you know, talking about a trade or an investment, you have to be quick. And the problem is people follow me from all around the world. So people are overseas, they're sleeping, they're in a job, they're walking their dog. They can't execute on it. So I'm like, okay. So then it kind of clicked into 2022. I'm like, well, what if we actually, instead of just be talking about education piece, what I'm doing, what I'm trading, what if we took away the biggest hurdle, which is people not being able to, you know, number one, execute. They don't have a successful trading plan and strategy that's actually back tested on data. And what if we built that into a software that then allowed them to be able to execute and not have to be staring at a screen all day? So then we transitioned that into a software. I launched a product. We had really great product market fit. So I'm like, all right, we're going to launch this brand and build this product just under this brand. So we have really clear brand identity. And yeah, it's just, you know, taken off since then.
Yeah. Yeah, I love what you said there about when the market's asking you for something, you have to deliver. I started writing a cryptocurrency research newsletter in 2016, And I had never written a newsletter before. I didn't really have an intention of doing that. I had been a subscriber to financial newsletters for 15 years at that point. So I knew the newsletter game, but I just started talking about Bitcoin. I started talking about the cryptocurrencies I was in, and people started asking me. Back in 2015, nobody was really talking about it. So like very quickly, I kind of became the go-to guy, just friends and, you know, extended network.
Yeah.
And then, like you said, it was like, well, what are you buying? What's in your portfolio? And I answered the same question so many times. I was like, why don't I just make some videos so they can just watch the video so I don't have to listen to it, right? And then like, hey, I'll just put my portfolio online. And then I was like, you know what? Why don't I just charge for it?
Yeah.
So then I started just my friends and friends and family. I was like, hey, give me, I forget what the time, I was like, I think it was $1,000 or $1,500. And if you don't double your money in a year, I'll give you your money back. Because I don't really need your money. I wasn't doing it for a job at the time. But it was back to just the demand demanded it, you know? And then at the end of 2017, in December 2017, when Facebook and Google banned all crypto talk and advertisements and all that, we had no way to sell. So we, but the market was telling, at the time I was just writing research reports, but the market wanted to like, they wanted to trade. They wanted to trade it. And I'm not necessarily a trader. So I brought on a trader, my business partner at the time. And in December, 2017, they banned advertising. We launched a brand new YouTube channel, but we introduced the product that everybody wanted, which was a day trading product, a signals
yeah.
thing.
Yep.
And we broke the ClickFunnels record. We did $1 million in 28 days with $0 of ad spend.
That's awesome.
But because the market was asked, we were talking about it.
Yep.
We were engaging our customer base. We were listening. They were telling us what they wanted, and we just delivered what they wanted.
Yeah.
It's you know, I was coaching some other entrepreneurs about how to like create content and generate leads and, you know, stuff like that we do. And the part they couldn't get past, and I kept telling them over and over, I'm like, you're not talking to enough people. You don't know what your customers want.
Yep.
And like, and it's a really big piece there.
Yeah, one of the first offers that I launched, I asked my you know, followers what they want to learn. I literally got a Jot form, which is just a software where you can build questions. And I just said, hey, what do you guys most value? Take this survey. And I think I said, I'll pick, you know, five people and pay you $100 or something like that. So I just launched a survey and I found out what they wanted, and I left open space for them to write it instead of just a yes or a no.
Yeah.
So then I would download all those keywords, and then I'd put it into a software that identifies, okay, what are the majority of the words that are matching between all these responses? And then I would use those words in the offer and obviously build the whole offer around what they said. But then you use those keywords in the marketing piece so that it clicks with the consumers. But if you're not doing that type of research,
yeah,
you're not going to know.
I did something similar, but it was much harder for me because I didn't have a list. So I didn't have anybody to ask that. Mm. And so I literally ran a Facebook ads campaign to an ask form. So I spent, I wanted to get 100 responses. I figured I needed at least 100 to get some sort of data. I forget how much I spent, $500 probably or something like that. And I literally ran a paid ad to a forum and said, what is your number one, you know, question or number one objection to, I think, investing in cryptocurrency or whatever it was. And it was just a forum. And I literally spent the money to get the data.
Yeah.
But whatever, it was $500. Then I took that data and then I was able to go launch the campaigns, and it worked really well. So it's a big piece. All right. So we've talked about all this. So now you have the help people build credit, which is an essential piece to building wealth.
Mm-hmm.
You have the algorithmic trading service now. So you're sort of democratizing access to like making money for most people.
Yeah.
And then you have the hedge fund, which is, I guess, for even higher net worth people that just I don't want to deal with it. Let me just let you do it.
Yeah.
So, and then we started talking about like you had your values, but your vision board and your living your vision board. So what is your vision for doing this? I mean, you're democratizing access to capital. You're trying to help people build wealth in non-traditional means. You want to bring a billion people into becoming millionaires.
Yeah. I mean, the untraditional piece is exactly, you pretty much hit the nail on the head. I've always been an unconventional guy. I always liked the underdog. So when I was also in traditional finance, I think that felt a little bit off.
Mm-hmm.
So I pretty much, the only thing that I invest in right now is alternative assets. So everything that I do is around alternatives. I like to be the underdog, and I like to help other people get access to things that they typically wouldn't, unless you're, you know, with Goldman Sachs and you're worth $20 million. Like, you're probably not even thinking about algorithms and automation, But like people, like I mentioned yesterday, they use all this automation in their businesses with Zapier and ClickFunnels and AI and all this stuff, but they don't even consider using that ever in their investment portfolio.
Yeah.
So yeah, the main thing is democratizing the access to different types of algorithmic trading. Our goal is to give them, you know, in their investment portfolio, we're not advisors or anything, we're a tech company, but I always talk about, hey, based on your portfolio, you know, it's still considered a high risk investment. Okay. But with inside of your portfolio, based on everything you understand, what is the piece that you would want to allocate to algorithmic trading? And then with inside of that piece, we want to give them an option, an array of products so they can diversify that exposure in their portfolio. So yeah, our main goal is right now, our main goal is to help 100,000 people directly. We usually onboard like just over 200 clients a month right now. We've got about, I believe it's last time I was in the low 3,000s in the, as far as clients. So we've got a ways to go.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's what we, our main mission is to reach, and impact 100,000 people directly through our products and then build a great community so that people can network and talk to each other and bounce ideas off of, oh, I'm using this broker. Oh, I'm using this setting. How does that change returns and volatility and drawdowns and things like that?
Yeah.
So yeah, that's our main vision right now.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rocked the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James. LeBron James.
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I love that. I love what you said about alternative assets, and that's been my path as well. I've done it unconventional, and I've only invested in alternative assets. And the reason why is because if we're going to play sports or compete in anything, compete in business, compete in sports, we need an edge. You know, if I was going to play someone taller in basketball, I have to play the game differently. I got to go under them or something. Yep. I have to be quicker or whatever. And there's just not a lot of, there's no edge in public equities, really.
Yeah, it's like, tough.
High frequency traders in Wall Street, they have an edge, right? Yeah. Like people buying order books from Robinhood, they have an edge. But you and I, we don't, right? But yeah. In alternative assets, we do, right? We can have a little bit of an edge there, I feel. And so I think that's why I've liked to compete in that space a little bit differently, as you have as well. What do you think about, so you have a finance degree, you worked at JP Morgan, the biggest bank in the United States. What's your outlook on the market, asset prices in the market? So there's, I don't think I believe it. It's fact. I mean, the economy and the markets are completely disconnected.
Yeah.
We just saw Japan officially entered a recession and the Nikkei index just made a new all-time high.
Yeah.
Europe just entered a recession and yet their indexes are up at all-time high, and the U.S. is teetering on the brink of a recession supposedly, and our indexes are at all-time high. So we saw in 2020 the economy literally was shut down and markets made it all. So that's disconnected. So let's just put the economy on the side over here for a minute. But just in terms of asset prices and markets, what are you thinking for the next couple of years?
Well, which asset class are we talking about?
You tell me.
So typically, if you understand markets, you understand that equities will oftentimes go on really strong rallies for 10 to 15 years, and they chop sideways for 10 to 15 years. I showed this chart yesterday.
Yep.
For many, many decades.
Cyclical versus, go ahead.
Yeah, so I believe that we're near a top in the equity market, and then typically commodities rally when equities are going sideways. So I think that commodities are the place to be, precious metals and Bitcoin and crypto. So I'm positioned definitely that way. I don't have much at all in equities. Like I said, I pretty much only invest in alternatives. So yeah, I think commodities are going to do very well over the next decade or so. It's hard to tell when we're potentially going to see a sell-off in equities, but I do think the whole market is just propped up by a few companies right now. Yeah. Specifically,
Nvidia saved the market.
It's saving everything. Yeah. So I think that here's the thing. If we didn't print 40% more dollars during COVID, I would think that we're going to have we're due for a massive crash. The X factor is all the new liquidity that is sitting on the sidelines waiting for a dip. So if we have the dip, because we have so much more cash, the dip just may be a lot more shallow, or the correction, or, you know, depending on, maybe instead of coming down 60%, we come down 30-40%.
Yep.
So that's the question that I'm asking myself, which I don't think anyone actually has the answer to, because no one's experienced the amount of, you know, cash that just got thrown into the market.
$6 trillion sitting in money market accounts right now, ready to pounce.
Yeah. Yeah. And you heard me yesterday, over, you know, the last 23 years, our money supply is up over 300%. It's close to 400%.
But, and so you're right, and I agree with that. So that money printing, the deficit spending. So the Fed's trying to reduce the market. They're trying to make you and I broke so we don't spend as much. But the deficit, the government is the fiscal spending is the problem, and they can't control that. And you showed charts yesterday in your presentation of the balance sheets and the debt just going up at higher and higher rates, almost like parabolic. And then you just said right now that that's sort of what's been driving these asset prices up to these astronomical levels. So then the question is, does that continue, or does the government just all of a sudden decide to spend 50% less money?
Yeah. Well, what you just mentioned is, you know, yesterday, over the last 60 years, the market actually only did the S&P 500 only did a 6X. But with inflation, it did a 51X. Mm-hmm. So yeah, everything's just being propped up by them, you know, printing money. And I don't see a reason why it would change, because they print more money by issuing more debt, but they also do it to devalue the debt so that they can, you know, devalue what they're, you know, owed. And then that allows them to pretty much just keep printing more money into infinity. And that's going to cause a huge issue for people that don't understand. That's why the poor middle class are going to get much more poor and broke, because they trade their time for money and they don't invest their money.
Right.
But then all the really wealthy people, they understand you have to invest your money, because if you're sitting in cash, you're guaranteed to lose over, you know, long periods of time.
And the other thing is, a lot of poor people listen to the Dave Ramseys, and they don't even listen to Dave Ramsey, but Dave Ramsey's don't use debt, don't use debt, don't use debt, don't use debt.
Yeah.
My mentor for 25 years now, my good friend Robert Kiyosaki, he said that most people should listen to Dave Ramsey because they don't know how to use debt. So they should probably not play with it. It's like a little kid playing with fire. you and I, we can light fires in our fireplace and warm our house, but kids shouldn't.
Yeah.
And most people are like that with debt. But you said yesterday in your presentation, and I told you I wrote it down, is that they are printing money to inflate away the debt, they being the governments.
Yeah.
But they're also inflating away our debt.
Yeah.
And so when you understand that, it's like, well, if I can use debt responsibly and they're going to continue to inflate away their debt, they're also inflating away my debt, then maybe I should learn how to play that game. So, my position is at this point, you know, it's the Keynesian multiplier, they call it. So Keynesian economics is that they're using debt to get growth. So to try to smooth over the dips, right? And the problem is that once you get over 90% debt to GDP, you're not getting enough growth for the debt you're taking on. And now we're up at about 125% debt to GDP.
Yeah.
So we're getting 40 cents of growth for every $1 of debt. That's called digging yourself deeper in a hole.
Yeah, that's a big
problem. And eventually it's 20 cents, and then it's 10 cents, and then it's no growth for the debt.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot of diminishing returns. I think we go out with a whimper, not with a bang. We print until we can't print anymore.
Yes. And then, you know, you and I will benefit because we understand what's going on. And that's why you and I both really agree on Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Because it's a scarce asset in cyberspace. They're not, we understand the monetary policy over the next 100 years. But people, like, even speaking yesterday, people were like, what's the halving cycle? You know, if more people mine, does more Bitcoin get released? And they don't understand how these things work. And now, you know, with the ETF approvals, I think more people are starting to realize what this whole Bitcoin thing is.
Yeah.
And I mean, the key is to realize that, you know, we're earning our wealth in something that is not scarce. In fact, it has an infinite supply that we can't even predict what's even relatively close to happening. We have no idea what's going to happen with the monetary policy.
Yeah.
But then you take that, you take the cash that you earn, you work as hard as you can to make as much as possible, and then you move that into scarce assets. And then you're going to benefit from all the stuff that's, you know, growing at an ever-growing rate that's quite worrisome.
Yesterday, you showed a chart of the S&P 500 divided by the money supply.
Yeah.
And how it hasn't made a new all-time high since 2000, right?
Yeah, the total U.S. stock market.
The total stock market, yeah, not the S&P 500, but S&P 500 the same way. Sometimes I look at the S&P 500 divided by M2. Sometimes I look at it divided by the CRB, commodity index.
Mm.
So you have to understand, you understand, but most people have to understand that everything's a trade, and so there's a nominator, denominator, and the dollar sits on one half of those trades. The problem is when we use the dollar as our measuring stick, to your point, it's constantly being adjusted. So we have this like faulty measuring. And so we think that we've made more money, but when you actually look at it and like, does it get you more goods and services? You realize it doesn't.
Yeah.
And so you can price S&P 500, you can price real estate, you can price whatever in oil. How many barrels of oil do I get? How many ounces of gold do I get? Et cetera. And when you price it in Bitcoin, you see a completely different picture. As a matter of fact, I posted on my Instagram a couple of days ago, 14 currencies and around the world have now made new all-time highs in Bitcoin. And if you take that chart, which you can see Bitcoin making a new all-time high in the currency, if you flip that chart upside down, what you see is the currency's crashing.
Yep.
Right, and so that's what we're seeing. So it's important to understand that. I try to pound that table, like your purchasing power. Like, am I getting more goods and services or less? And I think I did an interview with Jeff Booth a couple weeks ago, and he talked about how something I talk about quite a bit, but you have like, we don't want money. What we want is goods and services. The money gets us the goods and services that we want, the houses, the travel, the cars, the food, et cetera, right? And I'll store my value in money until I'm ready to get the goods and services that I want, which is why when they print more money, it pushes the price of the goods and services up, because you take all the goods and services of the world divided by all the money in the world. So he was like, if you take, he believes, and I think I agree with him, eventually, and this could be 50 years from now, I think Bitcoin will be a unit of account. I think it will emerge to that level. At that point, you take the wealth of the world, the assets of the world, 900 trillion divided by 21 million. It's 46 billion. Now, to put this into perspective, this isn't crazy. So like, there's a lot of people like Jim Rickards or whatever talk about how we were going to go back to the gold standard. I think that we may try that because there's no, like, fiat currencies are done. And the only way they could ever get any kind of trust back into fiat is to try to back it with something.
Yeah.
Which is why we see central banks buying more gold than any time in the world right now. So like, they may try to go back to the gold standard, but how would that work? Well, you would take all the currency of the world divided by all the gold in the world, and that would give gold a new valuation. That's how that works. Right now, if one of these BRICS nations with $100 billion says, I'm not going to buy treasuries anymore, I want to buy gold, you can't go buy $100 billion in gold. There's not enough gold at the current price, right? So the price of gold would have to come up in order for there to be enough, right? So you're basically taking the currency divided by the gold. But if we think about it, like I said, Jeff Booth was talking about $900 trillion in wealth divided by the 21 million. It's pretty amazing.
That's a pretty good ratio.
It's a good ratio. So we'll see. We'll see. The future's not guaranteed. But
yeah,
understanding these types of concepts, understanding price and value, understanding that money is just one of many measuring tools. These are all pieces that, you know, we started talking about that you need to continue to educate yourself on if you want to succeed and get out of the traditional kind of path that we're on. Of the traditional path of go to school, get a good job, work in a cubicle for 40 years, save for retirement, and money that's losing value.
And get a pension that's not going to be there.
Get a pension that's not going
to
be there.
Yeah. And I think the important thing is to realize what you just mentioned is like we're still at a place where there's asymmetric returns in Bitcoin and potentially other valuable assets.
Yeah.
But the thing is people don't understand what asymmetric even means.
Yeah.
And they don't understand asset allocation. So for me and you, maybe we're convicted, right? We believe in what we're investing in. So maybe our allocation to Bitcoin is a lot higher than other people. But then you look at people that don't really understand it. Even if you don't understand it to some extent and you understand the basics and fundamentals of it, it could just be an insurance policy and a hedge against what we're saying.
Yeah.
What if it is the 900 trillion divided by 21 million Bitcoin? That's obviously massive. That would be life changing. So risking 1-3% of your portfolio typically would make sense because you've got an asymmetric upside and a limited downside, because the worst thing that happens is you lose 1-3%. And there's a lot of studies that actually show in a traditional portfolio, 60% equities, 40% bonds, if you put in actually the optimal level that was done, I don't want to say it's by Bitwise, but it's two different companies have done this exact study and they came around to the same pretty much thesis, is that at a 3-5% allocation to Bitcoin, it will drop the volatility of the portfolio and double the return from, I believe the study was from 2014, you know, projecting about 9 years into the future. So just a 3-5% allocation can decrease the volatility and significantly increase the returns.
Yeah.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rocked the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James. LeBron James.
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of Bitcoin, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, I think, you know, I tell people, I like to say that the risk is not in the investor, it's in the investment. Mm-hmm. So if I took somebody from Kansas to Hawaii to pipeline where the waves were 30 feet and I said, hey, let me take you out in the water, they'd probably drown. But yet there's 100 people out there playing in the waves.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's what I mean, the risk being investment. So I typically tell people, like, if you say, hey, what's the best asset I should buy? It's like, if you don't know, you probably shouldn't buy it.
Yeah.
Because it's too much risk.
Yeah. You totally. If you don't understand anything about why you're buying something,
yeah.
Guess what you do? You buy the top and you sell the bottom.
Yeah. So go get some education.
Emotional roller coaster. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. Go listen to your content.
Yeah. Go get some education in that. But I wanted to ask you one last question. We'll wrap this up. You know, so now that you've been doing this for many years, you have the hedge fund. We're talking about Bitcoin and talking about the Bitcoin ETFs. Mm-hmm. So in technology, there's something called the diffusion of innovation, and it's like a bell curve. And a bell curve, and you've seen it, it's like in the beginning, you have about 7% adoption, which is the innovators, the people that developed it. Then you have what's called the true believers that come in, that gets to about 15% adoption. Mm-hmm. Then you have the chasm. Then you have the early majority and the late majority. Mm. And the chasm is there because something has to change in the mindset and the psychology in order for the early majority to join, like the true believers and the innovators. Mm. And so something in any technology, whether it's the internet, the iPhone, you name it, right? And the car is too dangerous. No, it's not. But then eventually something changes in the mindset where like, okay, I guess I'll get a car, right? And getting over that chasm is important. And a lot of people have thought that Bitcoin is ridiculous. It's magic internet money. I can't trust it. I can't whatever. But when the largest asset manager in the world, like BlackRock, is now running a Bitcoin ETF, and Larry Fink, that heads that, goes on TV and says that people are going to Bitcoin for a safe haven, mm-hmm. like that starts to change the mindset. That changes psychology. And what we're seeing now, about 50% of investments are actually passively managed. People's 401ks, you know, mm-hmm. et cetera. And those asset managers are adding Bitcoin allocations without the investors even knowing. Mm-hmm. So now people are owning Bitcoin and they don't even know it.
Yeah. They're doing the 1-3% thing I just mentioned.
Yeah.
Like Fidelity's doing that right now.
Right. And the question I was going to ask is that, you know, I think this is going to cross the chasm. It's going to legitimize it, you know, over the next couple of years. And I'm just curious, one, would you agree with that? And two, are you already seeing that? Like over the last couple of years, like have you seen the appetite in the public change, you know, people's even maybe just curiosity to it or more knowledge of it?
Yeah, I think we're on the verge of that adoption. I have been saying this for many years because I've seen this wave that's coming. I bought Bitcoin in 2013, actually, when I was in college.
Oh, you're ahead of me.
And then I sold it, you know, within the next year and a half. And then, you know, we went into a deeper bear market. I remember sitting down with a financial advisor in 2015 and saying, like, why don't you have some of your clients maybe just get a little bit of exposure to this? Like, what are your thoughts? Oh, no, it's scam. It's only used for this and that. And then, you know, I'm like a couple of years go by, then I started to get heavily back involved in 2017 when I was at JP Morgan. And then that's why I launched my fund around it, because I've been watching this industry grow. But this is I've been saying this for a while. This is the first time that retail can front run institutions.
Yeah.
Like this, you typically can never do that. Also, it's very rare that an asset class just comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Like how could you ask your dad when the last time that an asset class just popped out of nowhere and gave you the opportunity?
Oil, 1900.
Yeah. To invest in it before, you know, these firms with trillions and trillions of dollars. So it's happening right now, but I don't know. There's still a lot of skepticism. I think it's something that's going to slowly take place. And I guess it depends, like, at what point do you consider that? Is Bitcoin at a 5 trillion market cap? Is that a 10 trillion market cap?
It's different when for have everybody. We made it? It's different right? for everybody, you know?
Yeah, when I, you know, if I were to think, when is it going to go to a 10 trillion market cap? I think it's, I don't know, maybe a decade away or so. But it's hard to predict, obviously. It's impossible to predict. But I just know that, you know, I'm a longer term investor. Yeah. So I'm going to place capital where I believe is going to grow over long periods of time. And I think that we're in a serious wave that has a lot of momentum, but I don't know that we've eclipsed that. I think, like you said, all these firms that just launched that, those ETFs, that brings huge legitimacy to the industry. But I do think that we've got like another couple of years for people to realize like, okay, the ETF is not going away. And actually all these firms are putting 1-3% of 401ks and IRAs and all these other, yep. you know, pensions and things like that. So that's the big time money that is starting to come in. And I think we've got a couple more years until people are like fully accepted.
Yeah.
What do you think?
First, let's talk about what Fidelity thinks.
So they've been mining Bitcoin since
Since 2014. Yeah. They have, I think, the second largest ETF right now behind BlackRock. So they're on it, right? They've been on it for a long time. Their Bitcoin analyst, Timmer, what's his name? Man, I'm drawing a blank on his name right now. They put out a lot of reports, a lot of data on Bitcoin. They say by 2038, it would be $1 billion per Bitcoin.
A billion with a B.
But I want everyone to understand that $1 billion is worth nothing at that point.
Yeah.
In Zimbabwe, everybody became a billionaire.
Exactly.
And it was $350 billion for one egg.
Yeah.
So a home 30 years ago was 40,000. Today it's 600,000-700,000. I mean, yeah. right? So in 30, 40 years from now, $1 billion is like $1 million
yeah.
kind of thing. So that's their guidance. I think $1 million by the end of the decade, which is 6 years from now.
Yeah.
So that's a 20X.
Yep.
I don't see any other asset that has that potential.
I said that about two years ago. I was on another podcast with my buddies, Ravi. And I said, yeah, towards 2030, I think somewhere right around 800 to $1 million is somewhat yeah. realistic.
When you go back to, again, the charts you used yesterday and the rate of money supply growth, like I said, those trend lines, they just keep going up like this, which means the inflation is just accelerating. And when you understand back to the Keynesian multiplier that the growth we're getting from the debt continues to diminish, that means we need more and more of it, which means inflation ramps up, right? And inflation compounds. Because
yeah.
you talked about yesterday, you asked the crowd, do you know the difference of inflation and disinflation? Most people didn't really understand that. Mm-hmm. So when inflation goes from 9% to 4%, it's still going up. It's just going slower.
Yeah.
But it's adding on top of the 9% that we had just got. So you have to understand that it compounds, and compounding means it goes faster, faster, faster.
Yep.
And so, you know, I think, you know, I asked you the question, but to answer the question, I think asset prices broadly, real estate, is up 50% in 3 years from now. And by the end of the decade, it's probably up 150% from now.
Yeah.
And so again, like, yeah, it's $1 million, but $1 million is going to buy you a condo mm-hmm. and not in Miami.
And that's why, yeah, definitely not in Miami. And that's the thing. That was what I talked about yesterday, is even if you take the lowest conservative number of the increase in money supply over the last, you know, 23 years, it's 15% a year. But compounded at 6.53% a year.
Right.
So in any of your investments, if you're not outperforming 6.53% a year, like in your whole life policy where you have a guaranteed 4%, your bond where you're yielding 4%,
yeah.
you got a CD that's giving you 2%. All of that is going in, and here's my thesis is when people figure this out, that the inflation rate's actually a lot higher than what people believe from the CPI, what are they going to do with all those investments that have massive trillions and trillions of dollars in them that are yielding at these low rates? They're going to sell those investments. That's going to increase the velocity of money. And they're going to go buy something like Bitcoin that has a compounded annual growth rate of over 50% over the last 4 years. So I think that's going to further increase the amount of inflation and then further increase asset prices.
It's what Ludwig von Mises calls the crack up boom. And he says, and then suddenly people realize that inflation is both permanent and intentional.
Yeah.
which is what we're seeing today.
Yeah.
So to your point, when they realize this, when they realize inflation's permanent, the government keeps saying, oh, 2%, 2%, and intentional, permanent. And then they're going to try to exchange that money for assets as fast as they can.
Yeah.
It's the crack up boom. And that's kind of where we're at. That's why even though the recession's coming, the markets are crashing, people aren't selling.
Yeah.
People realize that.
Yeah.
I think that's a good place to end it. Jeff, you help people establish, build credit. You got the algorithmic investment platform and the fund. Shout those out real quick. We'll link those in the show notes.
Yeah. So the credit company is 0%.com. The algorithmic company is NERP.com. And then our hedge fund is Orca Capital.
Cool. We're going to link that to the show notes down below. And cool. Thanks so much, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mark.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.